Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Tomorrow, President Obama is expected to announce yet another plan for boosting jobs, this one centered on business tax cuts. But there is not much hope for bipartisan support. Despite the economy, congressional Republicans have very little incentive to back up the administration with midterm elections fast approaching. Joining me to talk about prescriptions for the seemingly stalled economic recovery, Dean Baker. He's co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Greg Ipp, he's U.S. economics editor for The Economist and author of a brand new book. It's titled The Little Book of Economics, joining us from a studio at Columbia University, Glenn Hubbard, dean of the Graduate School of Business, author of Seeds of Destruction. And joining us from his office, Jared Bernstein, chief economist and economic policy advisor for Vice President Biden and executive director of the Vice President's Middle Class Tax Force. Throughout the hour, we'll urge you to join us as well. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. And good morning to all of you.
Morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Jared Bernstein, I'll start with you. The jobs report that came out last Friday has been described as mildly positive. Give us a sense of where we are.
Well, for eight straight months, we've been producing net job growth in the private sector. These job reports have been a little bit tricky in recent months because of all the workers hired for the decennial census. As they came up, we saw big increases in the totals. As they came off, we saw decreases. So the best way to get a kind of straight read on it is look at the private sector. So far this year, the private sector has created over 750,000 jobs. That's not enough to get the unemployment rate moving in the reverse direction. At 9.6%, it's way too high for anyone's comfort. But if you think about the swing from where we were to where we are in the first quarter of last year, when President Obama and Vice President Biden took office, this economy was hemorrhaging jobs at a nightmarish rate. And I know you and Diane, you and I have talked about these numbers for years. I was going to say decades, but it's years anyway. I've never seen numbers like that. Well over 2 million jobs lost in just the first quarter of last year. 4 million jobs in the first 6-7 months of last year.
So what?
This swing from those horrifying negatives to positives is obviously good news, and I think a reflection of the way our policies have helped, particularly the Recovery Act.
Good news, but as you said yourself, certainly not enough. What is the president considering at this point?
The president in recent days has introduced a number of ideas. Yesterday in Milwaukee, he talked about an infrastructure program, really kind of the front leading edge of a multi-year reauthorization of the national infrastructure, surface transportation, focusing on roadways, on railways, and on runways. Ultimately, we're talking about rebuilding, repairing 150,000 miles of roads, 4,000 miles of rail, which, by the way, has special meaning to my boss, the vice president, is an advocate for rail travel, and that includes high-speed rail. and renovating much of the nation's runways. Along with that, the president's introduced some important tax incentives on the business side of the equation, things that will help bring some of that business investment capital off the sidelines, lower the cost of borrowing and investing. That's very important right now to help stimulate that sector in an economy where credit is flowing again, but again, not freely enough.
And what else might he introduce tomorrow?
Well, I don't want to get ahead of the president's introductions, but in recent days, I think the key point is that he has talked about very aggressively building on the momentum we have. You know, you're asking about tomorrow, and that's a fair question, but I want to talk for a second about yesterday, in a sense. You know, we have a very important and I think extremely helpful small business bill that's stuck on Capitol Hill because it's been filibustered by Senate Republicans. And in your introduction, you talked about kind of the political economy, what's going on. It's very important right now. I think folks need to know that we have a bill up there that is bipartisan in terms of its intellectual foundations, ideas that come from Republicans and Democrats to provide credit and, again, tax incentives, this time directed right at small business. And the idea that you would hold up a bill like that, $30 billion of credit, $12 billion of tax cuts over 10 years for small businesses, the idea that you would hold that up for political reasons in this economy is a terrible, I think, indictment of how some folks up there are using political motivation to block much-needed economic progress.
All right. Jared Bernstein, he's chief economist, economic policy advisor for Vice President Biden. Turning to you, Glenn Hubbard, what do you think of these approaches? Putting aside for the moment the political aspects of it, what do you think of these approaches?
Well, we're clearly at a time in the economy where we have to realize that we have long-term structural problems, and that over the past decade or so, policies both ignored those problems and in some cases made them worse. In the present environment, I think a key thing President Obama and his team could do is clarify the enormous policy uncertainty that they have generated in everything from health care to tax policy to regulation. In terms of the new proposals, certainly the proposal for investment expensing is a good idea. Many economists, I put myself in that group, suggested it 2 years ago. I'm glad to see the president do that. But the administration should know that some of that impact will be blunted by the capital tax increases they're passing. So I think what are they seeking? So I think what we really need is a focus on the long term.
Focus on the long term, Dean Baker.
Well, we have to focus on the long term, but I think the immediate focus has to be the short term. I mean, this really is a tragedy. We're still sitting here, 9.6% unemployment, very low prospect that will come down anytime soon. In fact, my bet is that we're going to see a higher unemployment rate, probably over 10% by the end of the year. And, you know, Jared's right. We're certainly happy we're creating jobs, but, you know, 70,000 a month doesn't even keep pace with the growth in the labor force. And, in fact, the trend is downward. We were creating jobs considerably more rapidly earlier in the year than we are now. So I'm happy to see the president's proposals. They're a foot in the door. The infrastructure in particular, I think, is good. We probably need to multiply that by about a factor of 10.
And to you, Greg, what realistically can the administration hope to accomplish before the midterm elections?
Very little, Diane. Let's go through these proposals. Let's just assume that the Republicans decided that they loved Obama and wanted to give him everything he wants. What would the impact be? It would be very, very small. A lot of these initiatives, for example, the business tax investment credit, all they do is they shift spending from one period into another. Now, the economy is so weak, so it would be nice to have a little of that business spending now instead of 2 years from now. But you talk to businesses, the cost of buying stuff is not the issue. Interest rates are at rock bottom. And in fact, business investment is one of the few bright spots in the economy right now. Their research and development tax credit, making that permanent, well, that's been part of their budget for years, and it gets renewed all the time. Just saying yet again we're going to make it permanent and actually making it permanent will just confirm what people already expect.
What about infrastructure?
That actually does have the potential to be very helpful. $50 billion in 12 months. It's not going to create 8 million jobs, but it's not chicken scratch either. And, you know, wisely, the president says we'll pay for it over 10 years with other revenue initiatives. Unfortunately, it's the thing that the Republicans are least likely to play ball with because they can portray it as more big-time spending. Essentially, everything here gets hung up on the horns of the Bush-era tax cuts, which all expire at the end of this year. And the Republicans have been clear they want all of them, including those for the upper-income taxpayers, extended. And the administration has been equally clear. They want to extend them for everybody but the people in the upper-income brackets.
And Jared Bernstein, what about those tax cuts? There's been so much said about them. Are they kind of a trading chip that you've got there in the administration with the Republicans who don't want any of what the administration's proposing?
Well, wait a second. I mean, the administration is proposing considerable tax cuts just with the expensing and the permanent R&D credit that are going to be extremely helpful for business. And by the way, let's not forget that almost $300 billion of the $787 billion Recovery Act passed in February 2009 was tax cuts. So our tax cut cred out there on the street ought to be very strong. I disagree, by the way, with one point that Greg made when he called the expensing initiative a small initiative. This is an initiative that could increase the investment of small businesses by $200 billion. I should say can reduce the tax consequences of investments of small businesses by $200 billion. Over the first couple of years. The longer-term cost is about $30 billion because he's correct, they're pulling investment forward. But $200 billion is big bucks. This is an historically very large tax incentive. One other point I wanted to make. You know, Glenn, by the way, I thought that the roundup you just gave was pretty favorable on the proposals the president has made. I think Dean is, of course, right that we have short-term issues, and we're working on those.
All right, Jared, short break here. We'll be right back, and your questions, comments are invited. And welcome back. We've got numerous people with us. Jared Bernstein is on the line. He's chief economist and economic policy advisor for Vice President Biden. He's executive director of the VP's Middle Class Task Force. Here in the studio, Dean Baker, he's co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Greg Ipp is U.S. economics editor for The Economist, and Glenn Hubbard is dean of the Graduate School of Business at Columbia University. Greg Ipp, is the administration getting credit for anything it's done right?
Well, broadly speaking, no. The president's approval ratings are going down. His approval ratings on the economy are even worse than his overall ratings. Intriguingly, his approval ratings on the deficit are even worse. And this kind of creates a dilemma, because if you wanted to help the economy right away, you'd probably increase the deficit. So whatever you do, you're going to lose support one way or the other. I think it's important to realize here that the administration has been handed a very, very tough hand. We know from previous countries that have been through financial crises that the recovery is always extremely weak. The simple matter is people are trying to pay down debt, either because they can't borrow, because they have too much debt, or because banks aren't willing to borrow. And so it's going to be a sluggish economy for some years now. Stimulus helps soften that process, make it a little less violent. But the sad reality is that it's going to be a tough couple years, and these are not environments that are conducive to long lifespans for politicians.
Jared Bernstein, realistically, what do you believe the administration can hope to accomplish before the midterm elections?
Well, I think that let me speak narrowly and then broadly quickly. On a narrow point, I think it's important to recognize that everything we've talked about so far in terms of new initiatives, at least in terms of the infrastructure and the R&E tax credit, are paid for. So there is a way to square the circle Greg mentioned, which is introducing programs and then making sure they're paid for over the 10-year budget window. I think in the broad sense, Diane, that's an important and not a hard question to answer, and the answer is a choice. Do you want to choose to move forward, building on the momentum of what we've done, what we've accomplished? Again, I take your point that many of the accomplishments are underappreciated or hard to pull out, and that's understandable given that the unemployment rate is so high. But if you look at where things were and where they are, whether it's unemployment, whether it's job creation, whether it's the housing market, whether it's the financial system, whether it's the auto companies, the choice is, do you want to move forward and build on that momentum, or do you want to move backwards to a policy set that, as Representative Sessions, the chairman of the Republican House Reelection Committee, said, we want to take things back to precisely the policy agenda pre-Obama in the Bush years. This is the policy set that created the mess we're into, a policy set based on trickle-down economics, based on inequality, based on deregulation, and it's precisely the set that got us into the mess. So I think between now and the election, we have to focus on the choice that's implicated here. The president did that, I thought, very effectively yesterday.
All right, Dan, turning to you, Glenn Hubbard. Your, new book is titled Seeds of Destruction, Why the Path to Economic Ruin Runs Through Washington, How to Reclaim American Prosperity. What do you say to Jared Bernstein's assessments?
Well, first, the problems that we're facing are a long time in making and have bipartisan roots. We have systematically over-worried about consumption and under-worried about investment for a long period of time in the economy. And I think to blame one set of policies misses the point of where we are now. I agree with Greg Ipp's observation that the president inherited a very tough hand. The recovery is likely to be difficult, but it doesn't have to be as bad as it is. We know from other cases in other countries at other times there are ways to respond to financial crises and do fiscal consolidations that are better. I think the box the president and the administration find themselves in is too lax, a lack of focus and a lack of content. The lack of focus was the economy is just now the focus instead of the unfocused stimulus package designed by Congress and a health care bill that probably made long-term problems worse, and a lack of content. So I think that's really where we are.
What do you say?
Can I respond to that, Diane, quickly?
Sure. Go ahead, Jared.
This is Jared. I think that where Glenn is coming from makes sense right now, and it's one of the reasons why you hear the president out here talking about significant investment programs that, by the way, Glenn is, appropriately cheerleading for. The thing about it is, though, is think back to where we were a year ago. You know, the Recovery Act is called the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. It actually has a lot of investment in it, but the investment was backloaded relative to the recovery initiatives, tax cuts immediately for families and businesses, state relief to help teachers and cops stay on the job. I think in discussions like you just heard from Glenn, I think the initial buffer that fast out-the-door program created, the 3 to 3.5 million jobs saved or created from that, has been critically important in the initial stages of recovery. Unemployment insurance, making work pay. I mean, Dean can speak to this as well, but I think we often forget where we were a year ago and how our actions helped to ameliorate some, not by no means all, but some of that pain.
But, Jared, how do you respond to the critics who say the president should not have put health care first? He needed to focus on jobs right away. He's coming to the issue too late.
Look, you got to walk and chew gum around here. And the president, I think, to his credit, and I don't mean credit today, I mean credit in a historical sense, didn't put his political finger up to the wind and said, what should I do? He looked at the unsustainability of our current health care system and the millions who are being poorly served by that. He looked at the medium and long-term effect of health care spending on the deficit, and he undertook in a politically tough environment to solve it, and he accomplished something that has eluded Democrats and Republicans for decades. I think it was an amazing accomplishment. And at the same time he did that, less than 4 weeks into office, he signed the largest stimulus package in the history of the nation. And while I understand that it hasn't done everything, it's made an important difference.
Glenn Hubbard.
Well, I think the stimulus package was $814 billion of tuition to learn that the Keynesian-style approach and near-term consumption support really wasn't the right stimulus package. I think that's why the administration is at the door again. Healthcare, you know, is probably the subject for another day, but what the plan definitely did do was not tackle and, if anything, raise healthcare costs and certainly raise the costs of employment. So whether or not it was good healthcare policy, I don't think it was, but whether or not it was, it clearly was unrelated to or adversely affecting the employment situation.
Dean Baker.
Yeah, I just wanted to get back to the point Greg made. I mean, the headwinds that the Obama administration is seeing, and he's absolutely right, we had a severe financial collapse, a collapse of the housing bubble, but this was entirely predictable. And this is why I can't understand. We're still talking about this like we're surprised by this. Now, my calculations are we lost on the order of $1.2 trillion in annual demand with the collapse of the bubble. About half of that is due to lost construction. We have huge overbuilding in both residential and non-residential real estate. That's not going to come back anytime soon. The other half is lost consumption, not because people have bad attitudes, but they lost on the order of about $6 trillion in housing wealth, and they're about to lose another $2 trillion as house prices continue to fall through the rest of this year. Now, we tried to make that up with the stimulus package, and let's boil this down a little. It's $814 billion by Glenn's number. That's ballpark. But we have things in there like the AMT that not by any stretch of the imagination was stimulus. And then some of that's spent later, which is fine. But if we say how much was actually spent in 2009, 2010, it's about $300 billion a year, and roughly half of that is offset by cutbacks at the state and local level. So what we're doing is we're trying to offset a decline in demand of $1.2 trillion with net stimulus from the government sector of $150 billion.
So you believe that the first stimulus package should have been bigger just to start with?
Absolutely. And what President Obama had to do, which I really give him blame for, is that he didn't sell it. He didn't say, here's why we have to do it. Private sector demand has collapsed. Government is picking up the slack. We know it's a big deficit. Big deficits are not harmful when there's a lot of slack in the economy, as there is.
So now, Greg, if people are talking about the, quote, new normal, what is that?
Well, I'm going to say something a little bit kind of odd for this show, and that's I'm going to be optimistic, actually, because we've had a rough period. As I said, we're in a deleveraging cycle. That means we've had businesses and consumers take on too much debt. And we've seen these before. We saw it in Japan. We saw it in the United States in the early 1990s. But as I talk about in my book, the long-term picture of growth is not a story about demand. How much do you and I spend today? It's about supply. How much can our economy produce? And one reason I'm optimistic about the United States is that our population growth is very solid. It's higher than almost any other country, including Japan. In spite of all the rhetoric that you hear about how Obama's a socialist and so forth, in fact, this administration, like every administration that came before him, believes it's a free market economy, that it can be made to run better. But I mean, this is a guy who couldn't wait to get rid of his holdings of banks and basically pushed General Motors towards an initial public offering. That's a long way of saying I think the infrastructure for long-term growth is there. And I even think that the last 6 months of growth are a little bit of an anomaly. We had a crisis in Europe that I think we hurt confidence. We had the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico that hurt confidence. Both those things are moving into the background. And I think there are small signs that confidence is picking up. The fact that the employment numbers for August, yes, they were weak, but they were a bit better than expected. There were a few positive signs in there. The stock market's got a bit of its mojo back. I think these are signs that things will be better in the next 6 to 12 months, not worse.
Greg Ipp, he's the author of the little book of economics, How the Economy Works in the Real World. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We're going to open the phones now. First to Clover, South Carolina. Good morning, Benjamin. You're on the air.
Thanks, Diane. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Thank you.
I had a question that I don't think either of your guests have addressed this morning. Given that about 1%, the top 1% of America's income tax brackets controls 40 to 60% of the wealth in this country, why aren't we talking more about raising taxes on them?
Well, the president is doing precisely that thus far, Jared Bernstein. What are the indications that the president will let the Bush tax cuts remain on the entire population?
The president has been very forthright about allowing the tax cuts to sunset for families like the ones the caller was speaking to. It's a very important part of tax policy, both in terms of the caller's question about increasing inequality. You know, something that's been underappreciated, a point Paul Krugman made in a column a few weeks ago, if you were to extend these tax cuts, over 50% of them would go to families, not in the top 1%, but in the top 0.1%, the top, you know, one-tenth of that top 1%, average income about $8 million. So that's how skewed these would be, and you're talking about blowing a $700 billion hole in the deficit if these tax cuts for the high end were made permanent. The middle class tax cuts, on the other hand, very important to maintain those, make sure that they're permanent, and that's our agenda.
Glenn Hubbard, what's your view of these tax cuts, letting them go for the upper part of the economy above 250,000 income?
Well, I think the caller raises a great question. The really big question is, what kind of government do we want? And the government in the president's budget is a government of 25% of GDP heading northward. The Bush tax cuts are in some sense a red herring there. We would need not only to let the top tax cuts expire, but really raise taxes on middle-income people if we want government that big, or we could cut government. My own view is that we ought to extend all of the tax cuts until we're ready to have a discussion about two things. And honestly, one, how big do we want government to be? And second, what tax reform do we need to pay for it? The dirty little secret is, if we want the president's government, we would have to raise taxes on everyone.
Dean Baker.
Well, this argument about how big do we want government to be, what we want, at least in my view, I think most economists would agree with this, is you want government to do what it does most efficiently. You know, for example, Social Security is much more efficient than private sector investment plans. We have an awful lot of data on that. In fact, Medicare is much more efficient than private insurance plans. Where it does things more efficiently, we should have the government do it. It doesn't make sense to say we want it done less efficiently because we have some magic number, 25%, 20%, whatever number you want, where government can't get bigger than that.
Let's go to Springfield, Virginia. Good morning, Vince. You're on the air.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
I am a small businessman, and in the past 2 years, I've seen my employee force going from 200 to a grand total of 25 today. So I want to know what it is that you think this bill is going to do for me by giving me, I don't need a loan, I don't need a tax break. What I need is a place to work, and I'll pay my taxes, and I don't need to borrow any money.
Jared Bernstein.
I think we have to think about two important parts of the economy right now. One, which is, I think, on the top of the scale, is what economists call aggregate demand, and that's what the caller is asking about. This is folks coming in the door to buy the goods and services that American businesses make and produce. There is nothing that's going to restore business confidence and get this economy humming again in that sector than folks doing precisely that, getting back to a normal, healthy, robust, self-sustaining expansion. That's what every part of our economic policy has been targeted at thus far. But we also can't forget that we had a huge financial crisis and that lines of credit were very much shut down. And there are many small businesses, not the caller, but there are lots of other small businesses who say they have they're creditworthy, they have projects ready to go, they have good plans on the shelf, and they're having trouble getting the credit they need. The small business bill on the Hill, filibustered by Republicans right now, would go a big step towards solving that problem, and it is part of the problem.
Dean Baker.
Well, I think, again, I think there are some cases where you have small businesses that have difficulty getting access to credit. I think far and away the basic story is a lack of demand. And again, this gets back to we lost $1.2 trillion in demand. We have to make that up somehow. I don't see another way than the government doing it, at least in the short term. I'm open to ideas, but I just don't know where that comes from.
Dean Baker, he is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He's author of Plunder and Blunder, The Rise and Fall of the Bubble Economy. When we come back, more of your questions, comments. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Vicki and Roger Sant and Island Press, which offers solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
Floods in Pakistan and China, record heat in Russia and parts of the U.S. For this month's Environmental Outlook series, climate scientists on what we can learn from extreme weather events. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And sorry to say, Jared Bernstein had to leave us. He is, of course, the chief economist and economic policy advisor for Vice President Joseph Biden. Here's an email. Please ask exactly how the last 10 years of tax cuts helped. We have the worst economy we've seen in decades, along with the lowest tax rate in 40 years. Historically, there is absolutely no correlation between low taxes and a prosperous economy. I would like to hear facts that cutting taxes for the wealthy helps the economy. Glenn Hubbard.
Well, it's a great question, and we have numerous examples. I'd say a key example that I would begin with is the Kennedy tax cuts and the introduction of investment incentives and cuts in the top rate that I think were very important for investment and expansion. We saw this as well for investment in the early 1980s tax cuts. And certainly tax cuts in the decade that preceded had very positive effects for consumption and investment. A lot of things go on in an economy besides tax policy. Where I really agree with the questioner is that we really have to think about a tax code that makes sense. And it's not simply extending or getting rid of tax cuts that are in place, but really rethinking tax reform, which would be a broad base and low marginal rates for all taxpayers.
Dean Baker.
Well, if you compare the Bush years to the Clinton years that preceded them, and again, lots of things were different. It wasn't just the taxes. But the point is the economy did quite well during the Clinton years. It grew rapidly. And most importantly, at least for I think most people, it was broadly shared. You saw good wage growth, particularly the last 4 years, 96 to 2000. Substantial rises in family income. By contrast, that fell through the floor. Wages were basically stagnant all through the last decade, and family income also was pretty much stagnant, and we had this buildup in the housing bubble that gave us this huge crash. Now, all of that is not cannot be blamed on the tax cut, but you have to look pretty hard to find anything that's very positive about that cut.
Here's an email from Lori. She says, this country was strong, had the best infrastructure in the world, until the Reagan tax cuts took the financial base away. The only way the U.S. can get back a solid infrastructure is to rescind the tax cuts back to where they were in 1974. The wealthiest people pay the most. The poorest people pay the least. These tax cuts are where our country lost the funding for infrastructure and is the true reason we are behind, along with outsourcing jobs over the past 30 years. Greg Ipp.
I think actually there's probably way too much attention by both Democrats and Republicans on the negative and positive impacts of the Bush tax cuts. In my estimation, they had far less impact, either positive or negative, than they usually get attention for. Federal taxes as a share of GDP has been around 20%, like with dips above and below, around 18% of GDP for some decades now. You know, the harsh reality in this country now is that both parties are in denial about taxes. You essentially have a Republican Party that says 100% of people should not pay higher taxes, and a Democratic Party that says 95% of people shouldn't pay higher taxes. Against that, you have the reality that spending as a share of GDP is at like a 50-year high and revenue is at a 50-year low. That is an arithmetic gap that has to be filled somehow. And unfortunately, everybody's going to have to get used to the idea that if we want this government, somebody's going to have to pay higher taxes. And that's not a discussion that we're having.
Let's go to Tim in Dallas, Texas. Good morning. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, I hear, you know, obviously this show is about what should the government do, what shouldn't the government do, but what I never hear really talked about in a serious, you know, way is the children of America. And by the children of America, I don't mean the kids of America. I think this country has acted like really spoiled children for a really long time, completely ignoring the elephant in the room, which was living beyond our means, driving up massive personal debt, negative savings rates for the most of the last decade at least, the real estate bubble, which we don't need to talk about that much more, and this is all from the richest country in the world. So in essence, my personal opinion is that we kind of got what we deserved recently in terms of the economy, but instead of being good little children and taking our medicine, we expect an immediate fix from the government right now, and more importantly, we want an immediate fix that we don't have to sacrifice anything more for.
Dean Baker.
Well, let me just say a bit about the personal debt, because, I mean, again, this is a horrible story. We can go back. The data is clear enough. Savings rate was basically 0.04 to 0.07 when the bubble collapsed. But this was actually a perfectly reasonable thing for people to do when house prices were going through the roof. So if someone's sitting there, they have a house that was selling, they paid $250,000, they have a mortgage on it of, let's say, $200,000, suddenly the house is worth $350,000, $400,000, $450,000. That happened many, many places. Perfectly reasonable thing in that context to go out and borrow $20,000, $40,000 against your house. You could use it to, you know, maybe you make the house better, maybe you buy a car, maybe you take a vacation, maybe you pay for your kids' education. All that is perfectly reasonable in a context where those prices are going to stay there. Now, of course, they didn't, but almost every economist in the country, I was arguing against them, I could tell you. All of them were saying, Dean Baker's a nutball, house prices are going to keep rising. And in that context, that was perfectly reasonable behavior.
But Tim is saying, now that all this has happened, we, the children, want it fixed right away, Greg Ip.
Well, you know, I wouldn't use the same words, but I essentially agree with exactly what the caller is saying. We're having basically a mother of a hangover from like a two-decade orgy of borrowing and spending and not saving at all. But the good news is that we actually are making progress. The saving rate, yeah, it went down to zero a few years ago. It's now back up to 6%, which is a lot of the way towards where economists think it has to go to start repairing the damage. Housing prices got about 40% above their justifiable level. They've basically come all the way back to something normal. Now, Dean here thinks they're going down further. I hope he's wrong. But in general, we have gotten rid of most of that housing bubble. This, as I was saying earlier, is a long, painful process of working our way through these debts. The banks have to write off all the toxic loans that'll never get repaid. People have to get used to the idea that they can't use their houses as ATMs any longer. But everything we've seen suggests that that process is underway.
Tim, thanks for your call. Let's go to Miami, Florida. Good morning, Seth.
Good morning. Thank you very much. And as always, I find your show very informative.
Thank you.
I'm hoping you can clarify a little bit for me, and I had some information earlier. From the previous stimulus, I heard that the economy grew at 0.4%. I'm curious as to how that relates to how much was spent as to how much it contributed to the economic growth.
Glenna Hubbard.
I think there's a wide range of opinion among economists, perhaps not surprising to anybody. I would associate myself with a view that the stimulus had a pretty modest impact. It's already come up in discussion that a lot of what was in the $814 billion wasn't stimulus at all, so it's not surprising it wouldn't have much impact. We could have given about $100,000 to every newly unemployed person instead of doing the stimulus. It just shows how wasteful it was. We need a better way, and the president, I guess, is now trying to find one.
Let us just say, for a point of clarification, that the president tried initially to get a larger stimulus package to do much, much more, but it was whittled back and whittled back. Same thing with the health care plan. Dean Baker.
No, well, that's right. The president's proposal was originally $800 billion or so of, I think, was more stimulatory than what he ended up with at the end of the day by Congress. I think even that was too little. We know from various reports that Christy Romer's chief economist had wanted to have $1.2 trillion. I think even that might have been on the low side. So he didn't get as much as he wanted. I think I differ with Glenn. I mean, again, I've been critical. It was too small. But the projections, the calculations from the Congressional Budget Office are that it reduced the unemployment rate by between 0.8 and 1.7 percentage points. Not enough. You know, we're still looking at 9.6% unemployment, but I think, you know, that's much better than, say, 11.
So, Greg Ip, you want to weigh in here?
One of the unfortunate things about macroeconomics is that it's not like an experiment where you can test a bunch of sick people and a bunch of healthy people to see if the drug works. You've got a situation here where the patient was extremely ill, running a high fever, a big infection. We gave him a lot of traditional antibiotics, and he's not completely better, but he stopped getting worse. We cannot prove that the antibiotics are the reason he's not getting worse, and we can't prove that if we hadn't given them to him, he'd be better. But most of what we know from economics, and this is nonpartisan people like this Congressional Budget Office speaking, is that it probably did some good. We're not sure how much good, but it probably did some good. But there are other things going on as well. The Federal Reserve did a lot of stuff. You know, they lowered interest rates to zero. They did some funky stuff like buying bonds. We had the stress test, which I think took a lot of uncertainty about the health of our banks away. So in some sense, we had like a three-front war on the crisis and the recession. Nobody will ever be able to prove how much each of those fronts contributed to the turnaround that we've had, or how much better things would have been if a different path had been pursued.
Greg Ip is the author of The Little Book of Economics, How the Economy Works in the Real World. And let's go now to Guillermo in Raleigh, North Carolina. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hello, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to just make a comment today. I listen to your show frequently, and over the last few weeks I've had many moments where I felt like picking up the phone and trying to interject. So my comment today, you were talking earlier about should Obama have focused on purely jobs in the front, was focusing on healthcare changes a mistake. And sometimes when I'm listening to the show, I get the impression that the people on the show are in their own little echo chamber and that they don't actually get out and talk to people, for example, like me, who buy their own health insurance, middle class. I have a wife with MS. I'm happy that Obama's our president. I don't want to go back to Bush-era tax cuts. I don't like the feeling that people are goldfish and they forget what it was like a year and a half, 2 years ago. So I'd just like to emphasize that sometimes the people on the show need to be more clear about when they're making a statement that is their opinion and not necessarily grounded in fact, because it can get confusing sometimes. People listen to this and think, oh, Obama shouldn't have done health care. He's doing terribly. He's about to lose the reelection. And, you know, I'm happy with Obama. I'd like him to win reelection, and I think that health care debate was important. You know, on Friday on your show, you had a person who said that Obama didn't try and work with the Republicans and that he could have gotten a bill through. And I've been watching the news for the last couple of years, and kind of seems like the Republicans didn't really want to help. And so, you know, there's a mismatch between what I see on the news, what I experience in my life, and what I'm hearing on these shows.
I certainly understand your point, Guillermo, and I'm sorry about your wife. I can imagine that's got to be very difficult for you. Is there a lack of understanding between what's happening in the real world and what's happening in the political world, Dean Baker?
I think there certainly can be and probably is. I mean, again, part of the story to me, I keep looking at the unemployment rate. We have 9.5%, 9.6% unemployed. That corresponds to 15 million people without jobs, another 9 million who are working part-time, would like full-time. We have several million more who have dropped out of the labor force altogether. That's a crisis. But here in Washington, there's this idea, well, we're on the right path, you know, things are going in the right direction. And I'll agree with that. But the point is, that's not good enough. So if we get back to normal levels of employment 6-7 years down the road, that's a large chunk of people's working lifetime where they've been struggling to get by. They don't get those years back.
Dean Baker, he's co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He's author of the book Plunder and Blunder, The Rise and Fall of the Bubble Economy. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And to Fort Worth, Texas. Good morning, Susan. You're on the air.
Good morning. Well, there's just lots and lots I could say, but I've got a couple of points that just recently, and I agree with the last two callers. I heard the CEO of Mott's, the applesauce company, the last day or two, and he was very smugly justifying why he and the other CEOs should be making these huge amounts of money while hiring part-timers for his company. People need to understand over the last at least 30 years that CEO pay has gone from 40% of what their employees make to over 400%. And I think if this keeps up, we're going to eventually have a revolution because of the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer. We're going to turn into Mexico.
Glenn Hubbard.
Well, I couldn't agree more with the thrust of the question. We have seen very large increases in executive compensation. There are many CEOs who are well worth the money they're paid. But there's also real questions, and the questioner raises one, whether the process we have for compensating executives always leads to fair outcomes. I think that's an open question. I think we're a long way from becoming Mexico, but I do think it's a very, very important question for corporate governance. Yes.
What about Wall Street's role in this entire crisis and how it could affect our getting back to the new normal, Greg Ipp?
Well, they certainly had a big role in us getting into the mess. I'm not sure I would look to them for helping us get out of the mess. Interestingly, we had a very, you know, spirited debate for the last year as we moved towards getting the financial regulatory reform bill passed. And there was a lot of concern, you know, in the run-up to that bill passing that the government would impose a lot of unnecessary regulation and this would hurt lending and so forth. It's early days, but we don't really seem to have seen that. In fact, I've seen some signs that credit might finally be loosening up, which I think speaks to the fact that the real issue out there isn't, you know, the regulation. It's just the uncertainty over everything. You know, the other caller had mentioned healthcare. I will say we had talked earlier, is the president getting approval, you know, benefit of the doubt for anything? Actually, his approval on healthcare has actually gotten a little bit better in the last 5 or 6 months, I think perhaps because it's sort of dropped out of the headlines.
Dean.
I was going to say with Wall Street, I really see a lot of the problems centering there that, you know, certainly the bubble itself is fueled by Wall Street speculation. But also getting back to that other caller's point about the CEO pay, Wall Street really is the center of outsized pay packages, and I'd love to see those brought in line. My favorite method is a financial speculation tax. You could raise a ton of money that way, get rid of a lot of the waste on Wall Street. And also, I think that would put some downward pressure on the pay of these CEOs. Basically, they point their own boards who then go out and give them big paychecks. That's a good deal. We'd all like that.
Glenn Hubbard, last word.
Well, certainly we've had Wall Street problems throughout the financial crisis, but two things haven't been mentioned in this discussion. One is the role of the GSEs, Fannie and Freddie, that were implicit wards of the state before they were explicit, were the vortex of the crisis, and the Federal Reserve's easy money policies early in the decade also helped fuel it.
All right, we'll leave it at that. Glenn Hubbard is author of Seeds of Destruction, Why the Path to Economic Ruin Runs Through Washington, How to Reclaim American Prosperity. And Greg Ipp, he's U.S. Economics Editor for The Economist, author of the new book, The Little Book of Economics, and Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, author of Plunder and Blunder, The Rise and Fall of the Bubble Economy. Thanks to all of you, and thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.